Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and sadly, all good things must come to an end. Not the end of Talking Scared. April Fool's was yesterday. I'm not pulling that stunt. Rather, this episode marks the end of two glorious intertwined trilogies. The first, more importantly, is Stephen Graham Jones's Indian Lake novels, his masterwork so far. The other is this trio of conversations that Stephen and I have had about those novels over the last 3 years. Today, we're mostly talking about the new concluding volume to the trilogy, The Angel of Indian Lake, and we are completely spoiler-free. But take my advice, if you haven't already done so, go back and listen to our previous two conversations. It's episode 54 and episode 129. They really do work as a wonderful, combined, evolving insight into Stephen's thoughts and feelings about the series as a whole. Now, today we obviously talk about slashers and final girls, hopefully with lots of new things to say, but we roam wildly in the inspirational, motivational, ever so cool way that only Stephen can really pull off. We go from the comic book that saved his life to his struggles with writing what he calls the boring parts of stories, and we discuss the role of violence, poetry, and look on the page. This is a big episode, one of my favourites ever. And if you like it, do me a favour, leave a review on Apple or Spotify or wherever you review your podcasts. And as ever, if you want more, you can get it easily from the Patreon channel. Just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod, sign up for a few quid and make a real difference to supporting this show, as well as getting access to the hundreds of hours of extra chat that's now on there. But now, one last time, come with me to a battered and bruised town somewhere in Idaho. There's a monster running amok and a girl ready to put it down once and for all. Let's talk scared. Hello, Stephen. Welcome back to Talking Scared. How are you?
Man, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you. Well, you know, when I started this show, we timed it just right to catch you after Chainsaw came out, and and then we did Reaper, and today we can complete our own little adjacent trilogy of conversations about Jade and Proof Rock. So yeah, it's quite nice to tie it all up. But I mean, The Angel of Indian Lake, it's one of the most rabidly anticipated books of the year. But at this point, how are you feeling?
Man, I'm feeling nervous. That's how it always feels before a book comes out, because I know that I've put everything I can into it, but that does not guarantee that it's going to connect with readers and that it's going to find its people, you know? And I feel like if I didn't do it right, then I've betrayed so many people who believe in Jade Daniels, you know? So this writing a I never knew this. This is my first trilogy. I never knew like the sense of responsibility you have at the end of a trilogy, but it's real and palpable and terrifying.
Has the pressure mounted with each book?
It has. And, but I love pressure too. That it's where you prove what you can do. In school, I always loved tests and, you know, spelling, chemistry, history, whatever, because number one, I knew I was never going to study, which meant I had to really think on my feet for the duration of that test. And I could usually ace the tests. And I love pressure. I love deadlines. I love pile more and more on, because that's when I do my best, you know, but it's always scary. It's always a gamble. It's always a roll of the dice.
Last time we spoke, you said a thing that I've remembered ever since. I didn't even need to listen to the episode back to recall this. You said that you love to write yourself into a corner and then see how you escape. And that has really stuck with me ever since.
Oh, thank you. Well, with Angel of Indian Lake, you know, as I think I say this in the acknowledgments probably, but the only real prep work I did for Angel of Indian Lake was I wrote another novel real fast. I was a teenage slasher because I wanted to start from zero. I wanted my head and my heart to be absolutely empty so that I could fill it with the waters of Indian Lake, you know?
And fill it you do. And I mean, I don't mind saying this to you because I've said it to you before, but every time I start one of these Indian Lake books, I spend the first 100 pages deeply irritated, thinking this isn't working for me. Was it's just it's too many references. I don't get it. It's a jungle of this quote and this title, and then somewhere along the way there is this sleight of hand that I don't know how you do it, where you drag me in and I finish the book in tears. And it happened again. And damn you, Stephen, it's a magic trick and I don't know how you do it.
Oh, thank you so much.
And I've had a few listeners over the years say to me that they've really struggled with these books. And I always say, keep going. You will get there. And they almost always write back and say, yeah, you were right. But anyway, listen, we've jumped the gun. It's, you know, it's been a long road. A lot has happened. We're going to take it today as read that listeners are familiar with the first two books. And if you're not listeners, be warned of that. So I suppose at this point, Stephen, can you start us off by getting us up to speed? Where does this book find Jade? What's it about from here? Whatever you think the listener needs to know.
You know, and between My Heart Is a Chainsaw and Don't Fear the Reaper, Jade was dealing with legal problems, and she was mostly in a holding cell for 4 years before she came back to face off against this Blizzard and Dark Mill South and anyone else who was involved. And just like in keeping with that pattern, between at the end of Don't Fear the Reaper, Jade's being let off in handcuffs, basically, and she serves another stretch inside. So she comes back, and it's now, what, 2023, Halloween season, and bodies are dropping again. The forest is on fire. No one knows who's doing this, why this is happening. And Jade, you know, in Chainsaw, she hoped and prayed for a slasher to come. In Reaper, she was apologetic for having opened that can. And in Angel, she doesn't want to be involved anymore. She thinks she's aged out of this, that other people should be able to handle it, not her. Yet the story, the world, the proof rock, the genre, it all is bottlenecking her such that she has to wade into these bloody waters one more time and face off against stuff that she probably shouldn't be able to put down.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't think anybody is going to be able to guess who the adversary is, plural, are in this book, because you throw the entire slasher sort of rogues gallery of proof rock at this book, don't you? There's no one single line through it.
Yeah, like in Chainsaw, I had Jade completely invest that it was going to be one person behind the mask, and it ended up not being what she guessed. She was guessing what she guessed because of her own trauma. And then in Reaper, it was also I think it's this person. This person's obviously doing it. And surprise, it's not that person. So what that meant to me was that in the third book, I had to build it differently because the slasher audience is so smart. The slasher audience, it's kind of like they're all Vladimir Propp with the morphology of the folktale. They know that if you see these two characters doing this certain in this certain relationship to each other in the first 10%, they can guess what's going to happen 16 steps later. So on the slasher, you're both bound to deliver X, Y, and Z. Like, you have to do this, this, and this. You have to ring these certain bells. These are the conventions. You're like in a contract. You're obligated to deliver that stuff. And I love that. But at the same time, you have to pull the rug out from under the audience's feet in some way, like Scream does. You know, Scream rings all the bells, but it also surprises us. And for me to do that in a third installment, I couldn't do it the way I'd done it in the first two. And so you're completely right. What I had to do was put everybody into a colander and throw them against the wall and let the reader invest in, okay, it's this noodle, not that noodle, you know, but you're right that you can't really guess it. And that was the only way. Maybe a better writer could have figured out another way to do it, but that was the only way I knew to still surprise the audience. It's the only way I came up with that kind of fit with Jade and Letha's emotional arc, you know?
Yeah. I want to weirdly start with the end, because in this book, you give us this afterword, right, which is, in many ways, as moving as the story itself. I mean, Jesus Christ, the love letters you write to your wife through these afterwards put the rest of us to shame, right? But, I mean, you've already alluded to this, that you wrote a whole other novel before you even started this. And in the afterword, you describe a very tight deadline. But mm-hmm. you also describe feeling uncomfortable with writing about violence in the mm-hmm. world at that moment because of real world events.
Yeah, I was working on the prologue. Like in the prologue for Chainsaw and Reaper, it's both young people being like senselessly slaughtered, kind of to establish the mortal stakes of this. And like in slashers, I don't really like to play the game of is it or isn't it a haunting or a magic or a terror or whatever it is. I like to, you got to hit the ground running and say, yes, there are these mortal stakes. There's somebody doing something bad and we all got to figure out who it is and how to survive it. But in the third one, like the slasher and the momentum of the trilogy kind of bound me to have to kill a couple of teenagers up front. But then the shooting down in Uvalde happened, and for the first time, I felt really bad and reluctant to kill a couple of teenagers in my book, you know? Like back when Columbine happened in 99, the Columbine shooting, I remember that a lot of the horror movies got dialed back violence-wise, and some productions got canceled because, you know, kids being killed was in the news cycle, and to do it in our media cycle felt kind of exploitative. And I didn't feel exploitative. I just, about opening Chainsaw with a couple of teenagers messing around at night and facing something that they can't put down, they can't resist. I felt like I was part of the problem, you know, not part of the solution. I don't pretend that novels like actually provide solutions or fix the world or anything. I think the best that a piece of fiction can do is start a conversation, maybe ask a question, maybe shine a light on something, but we can't actually fix things. We're artists. We just stir the pot, you know. I don't think we actually compose the big solution. But I think that's why this prologue with, you know, Hetty and Paul, I think that's why it probably is the longest prologue in the trilogy, because I wanted to prop these kids up, and I wanted to let them, if not live, at least have lived. And for them to have lived, that meant I needed to give them more real estate on the page to kind of not, I would say delve into, I don't know if delve into is the right word, expose is the right word. I just wanted to be able to make them real on the page. And therefore, this prologue is probably three times longer than any of the other prologues. And it's simply me holding on to them as kids that I think should get to live, if that makes sense. And I was questioning, am I, like, horror writers, we're supposed to be brutal. We're supposed to be able to just like thump characters off the page left and right. But I was actually interrogating whether I had that anymore, you know, and it wasn't easy. It wasn't fun at all. But tell you the truth, should it be fun? I don't know. I don't know if it should be fun.
I mean, that's a whole conversation, right? About what is the morality of horror in relation to real world events. I mean, it goes all mm-hmm. the way back in the UK to like the video nasties where films are getting banned because they thought they were instigating violence. And I mean, it's a massively complex conversation. Mm-hmm. Which we don't need to have, to be honest, because I think your book speaks for itself, because you use the word interrogate. And mm-hmm. I think the thing that, right, not that there is a hook to even get you off, because I don't believe horror is to blame in any way. So there's no hook to get you off. But if you did think there was a hook there to get you off, the fact that your books, and these books in particular, are all about interrogating, you know, the brutality of what a slasher would really be like, the trauma that comes after it, all of that stuff, mm-hmm. that seems to validate the project itself without you having to go on any kind of soul searching. I think you're already doing it, you know?
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad you're getting that from it. I wish I would have had you there when I was writing it to tell me that stuff. So it'd be less of a grueling. I mean, I'm not one of those writers who pretends like, oh, writing is so hard, you know, like, look at me, I'm toiling in the mines. I think to me, writing is play. It's a recess, you know, it's just playing, having fun. But, for me, this prologue was actually, a little bit difficult, and it wasn't difficult because it was hard to write. It was difficult because it was hard to conceptualize. It was hard to do it without feeling guilty, I guess. But I think you're right. I don't think horror needs to be let off the hook. And, you know, when I say that fiction doesn't fix anything, I think that's also probably me setting up the fact that fiction is also not responsible for anything. You know, I don't mean to say we don't have a function. I think art has a function for sure, but our function is not necessarily to diagnose this ill and provide the proper prescription, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, I'm thinking about very big things on my feet here, but I would say that, I mean, who the hell am I? But my opinion would be that, yeah, all right, a novel may never change the world. You know, there are a handful of them that probably have, but I think a novel could change somebody's world. I think on a personal level, a novel can be the solution to a problem. If it comes on at the right time and tells you just what you need to hear for better or worse, it can be a literally world-changing event.
I totally agree with that. Like, I used to always, like, I remember 20 years ago in interviews and book talks and stuff, I would say, you know, when I was 11, a book saved my life. And I remember after one of those talks, Gerald Visner, one of my heroes, was there, and he pulled me aside and he said, "What do you mean a book changed your life? Tell me, has a book really ever, like, saved your life?" And I had to think about it, because I had just been speaking generally, so I had to think about it. But yes, I think I have had a book. I have had a book save my life. And I mean, the book that opened me up to fiction was when in fourth grade I read Where the Red Fern Grows by Wilson Rawls, and that just changed the shape of my brain and my heart, I feel like. But you're talking about a book changing an individual instead of changing the world, and that individual can hopefully change the world. Yes. But for me, like, Secret Wars number 10, I guess it is. I feel like that book saved my life, you know, the comic book.
Yeah. This is where my ignorance shows. That's Avengers, right? Secret Wars. That's the alien race? Oh God, I'm so stupid with this.
Oh no. There are some Avengers in it. It's 1984. It's Jim Shooter. It's really, they wrote this series to sell action figures through Hasbro, I think it was. It's totally a tie-in thing. It wasn't even like somebody had a great idea. The great idea somebody had was, look, let's sell some new action figures. Why don't we come up with a story to sell them? It's a 12-issue limited series where this cosmic entity called the Beyonder opens a little aperture, looks in our dimension, and sees desire. He has no idea what desire is because he's omnipotent in his own realm. And so he spirits away all of our heroes and bad guys, or a lot of our heroes and bad guys, to this planet he constructs called Battle World, in which the good guys and the bad guys both desire to beat each other. And so he wants to just anthropologically, sociologically study desire. But one of the people he spirits away is Dr. Doom. Dr. Doom always has the biggest ideas, you know, and he says, I'm not going to fight these. I'm not going to find Iron Man and Spider-Man and Hulk. I want your power, Beyonder. And so Dr. Doom builds this special suit. He always built a special suit of armor, and he comes up Beyonder to try to steal his power. And Beyonder, of course, he's like an omnipotent god. He's not gonna let some little puny mortal, no matter what suit he's wearing, steal his power. And so he's blasting Dr. Doom, and there's a panel in there where Dr. Doom is, he's lost a leg, he is mortally wounded, he is falling apart, but he's still reaching forward trying to get that power. And I read that when I was 12 years old, and all through high school, which, you know, my teenage years were quite tempestuous, I guess you could say. There was always police officers and guns and knives and mental health people. Like, it was just a roller coaster of I don't know, after school special stuff, I guess you could say. Or maybe more like Cell Block. What is that Vince Vaughn movie where it's really violent? It was over the top.
Oh yeah, what's like it?
I forget what it's called.
Brawling Cell Block 18 or something.
Yeah, that sounds good. Every time I would be in a position where the world was so against me and I should quit, I would remember that panel with Dr. Doom where he should have quit too, and he didn't quit. And I would say, you know, if Dr. Doom can push on when he's mortally wounded, when he's missing a leg and all that stuff, then so can I. And so I would keep walking forward, you know, and in that way, I feel like a book saved my life. And I feel like there's been so many books since then that have given me what I need at that moment, you know, and that's the one most wonderful feeling, when you don't even realize you're in any kind of crisis. And then you read some book and you're like, oh, they have that feeling too. They have that terror too. I'm not alone. I can probably get through this. And that's a pretty wonderful feeling.
Yeah, for people like you, and to a degree, I'm reluctant to put myself in the same category, but for people who live creative interior lives, mm-hmm. I think sometimes we fetishize our own thoughts and think we have these special little thoughts that no one's ever had before. And when they're frightening thoughts, that can be a really frightening thing. And then you read a book and someone articulates this way you feel in a way that you never could. And you're just like, oh my God, someone else has had this frightening thought or this.
Yeah.
It's an incredible thing when that happens.
And it's also terrifying. Like, I remember when I was reading Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, and what's that guy's name in there? Perry. He's talking to Perry in his cell, I believe it is. And the things Perry are saying, they were like 98% exactly what the interior of my head is like. And I was like, this is so familiar. And also, I don't like that I share headspace with this dude, you know? but I had the same thing happen with Red Badge of Courage. You know, when I read that, there's that guy in there. What's his name? I forget his name, but he's a soldier, but the thoughts he's having, are kind of wimpy for the thoughts we ascribe to somebody going to battle, you know, mm-hmm. but those are my thoughts too. And when I was reading him, and I probably read that when I was 13 or 14, I felt a little bit less alone, you know, and it was pretty wonderful.
Yes. And I strongly imagine, and this sounds like the kind of thing that people say to authors to try and butter them up. And it's absolutely not in my case. I strongly imagine there are a lot of people out there who get that from Jade. Because make Jade this, she's an open wound of a person. You know, she's mm-hmm. she's walking trauma, a thought disorder with legs. And through the worst things that can happen, she strengthens and hardens and heals herself. But the beautiful thing about her trajectory is she flourishes beyond what happens to her. You know, she becomes a genuinely better person, but in a way that's really authentic. And I'd imagine there's a lot of people who read Jade and take the kind of things we're talking about from her, you know?
Oh man, that's the highest honor. If a young woman, like if just one young woman out there in the world reads about Jade and feels in some way less alone, or maybe even has one more tool or bolster or something to push back against the bullies in their lives, then I think it's been it's done something good, and I feel better about having done it, you know, or having been a part mm-hmm. of it, I guess. I don't feel like I did it. I feel like I just stumbled onto Jade and she wrote these books. You know, I don't feel like I was that involved really.
Okay. Well, you can say that. We're all going to just clap you on the back for it. but you've mentioned that before in previous conversations we've had about, you know, the bully in your life. And uh-huh. the slasher is basically just one big bully. And I get that. But something uh-huh. else, in the proof copy in your editor's note, which mentions my review that I was really thrilled to see. But in that note, your editor writes that, and this is the quote, "Stephen likes to talk about the slasher as a genre for justice." Face value, that feels like a really obvious thing. And then I started thinking about it, because justice, the dedication for this book is to Jason Voorhees. And you say, "I would have swum out there for you. We all would have done." And then it got me thinking, who are you trying to find justice for in these books, Stephen?
I think I just fantasize about living in a world that's fair. You know, I fantasize about living in a world where kids don't go to bed hungry, where people don't get to say bad things at microphones and then walk away with no consequences, you know? I dream of a fair world, but the problem is, how do you get to that fair world? And the only way I've ever found to get to that fair world is some breed of brutality, you know? Actually, I wish I had it handy. In my novel Demon Theory, the epigraph, it's a novel in three parts. The epigraph for the second one, I think, is by a guy named Jerome Stern, a poet, I believe. Oh, this may have been a piece of nonfiction that he wrote. He says something about like the way through is possible. Like, okay, I can't say that. He says that to get to the happy place, you have to walk through the brutality. And I wish that weren't the case, but that's the only way that I see it working. I want to live in a fair world. I want to live in a world where the bad people get their just desserts, you know? And I think that's a dangerous world to live in, because you have stuff like, you know, people shouldn't get decapitated for littering, you know, like that's going to happen in a Friday the 13th movie. I don't really subscribe to that kind of fairness, but I don't know. I want things to be good for everybody. And yes, the slasher is a justice fantasy, and there's all kinds of transgression and brutality and violence and gore in it, of course, but there's also good. I think there's some good we can be left with after all that bloody fun.
Yeah, I'm sort of thinking there, because with the slasher, when you read commentary about the slasher, because so much, you know, comes from Carol Clover's The Final Girl. That's yeah. where all slasher commentary seems to stem from. We put all the onus, don't we, on the justice almost, or it isn't justice, but the rectification, I suppose, is a better word.
Yeah,
the
yeah,
correction yeah. of transgression. And the transgression is always the victims. It's always the rules of Scream. If you transgress these rules, whether it be take drugs, have sex,
yeah,
you know, yeah. all of these things, you will die. People, I think, forget that the actual justice is that yeah. the monster is slayed in the end.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the slasher, yeah, Michael, Jason, Freddy, whoever, they're put down temporarily. And that's the end to this little cycle of justice. But of course, they come back again, because it's kind of like a sitcom, like the world resets every between episodes, you know, and suddenly yeah. there's more rights to be wronged, and then there's even more rights to be wronged. Like in Friday the 13th, Jason's mom is initially killing campers because they let her son die, but then Jason is killing counselors, campers, anyone who comes into his like slashing sphere or radius, because the outside world is who cut his mom's head off, you know? And so he's on his own little revenge arc, and he can never be satisfied because everyone is some version of Alice. They would cut his mom's head off, you know? Mm-hmm. But I like it when a slasher goes into a franchise mode, because when a slasher is a one-off, I'm not saying the one-offs are anyway failures, but I like that the supposition, or kind of like the underlying premise, that the solution doesn't hold, the fix doesn't stay. You know, we did right the world for a moment, but when we looked away, it all went out of balance again, and someone's got to rise to fix it.
I'm glad you mentioned franchises, because you're way more of a slasher fan than me. It's just, it's not the kind of horror that particularly mm-hmm. floats my boat. This is why I love your book so much, and why I love Grady Hendrix's Final Girl Support Club, because they did for me what the slasher doesn't do for me, which is give it some emotional heft. But mm-hmm. you love them. I want to talk about them. And I want to talk about the meta angle. Although actually, no, meta's the wrong word, because you never actually break the fourth wall in these books. Let's say referential.
Uh-huh.
It feels like you go particularly hard in this one. There are references to some, like, I mean, I know my horror, but there are some things I've never heard of in this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jade, at parts, the more dire the straits get, Jade starts using horror culture as a kind of like primary source of description or metaphor. Did you intentionally kind of, you know, up the ante on that one? Is it because you know that by now you're writing for the initiated?
Probably a little bit of that, but like Jade's interpretive model for the world is the slasher. And so everything must pass through that filter to make sense to her. Therefore her explanations, of course, always hinge on, or at least utilize, you know, slashers and maybe horror in a larger sense. But tell you the truth, I think ever since film kind of metastasized out, or cinema, I should say, metastasized out into the world, I would give that probably right after the silent era. I think it started going wider and wider. I think it like reshaped our minds, because we now think of things in terms of like flashbacks. And I think when we talk about our memories, we talk about them in almost a cinematic way. So I think we're all Jade in a sense, and that we're infected with cinema. We can't get away from that. I mean, maybe there's like Emily Dickinson's out there who hide in their attic and don't have a TV and don't go to the movies, and they're lucky, they can still recite speeches and stuff. But I think the rest of us have been so thoroughly infected But by cinema, and I'm not saying it's a bad infection. I think it's just a change. It's an evolution that we all use it as an interpretive model, and it's between us and the world, you know, and it's between us and our conception of the past, the future, everything. And I don't think there's any getting away from it anymore. So Jade using the slasher as that lens through which she makes sense of the world is just like a individual level of what has happened to the world at large, to me anyways.
Infected by cinema. I really like that, because I've one of the primary obsessions of my life is the concept of the hyperreal. For full nerdiness with footnotes, it's a theory put forward by a critic called Jean Baudrillard. Listeners, great. But he wrote a book called The Gulf War Did Not Take Place, which was about the idea that the first Gulf War was an entirely televisual event, and that it was all spectacle, and the spectacle mattered more than the reality. And then when you look at 9/11 and the fact that we all said it's like a movie, everyone viewed 9/11 through the prism of movie. And now even this year, you've got this, you've got what's going on with Trump and Biden and all of that. And then you've got this movie called this Alex Garland Civil War, which is going to completely distort the reality of the election if it's a hit.
Yeah.
You know? So infected by cinema. I like that a lot.
Thank you. Thank you. And I think, yeah, I think in probably 7,500 years, if we are still around, if we learn to breathe like air that we don't have and drink water that we don't have and stuff, then I think people are going to look back to this time and be able to, with the advantage of distance, they're going to be able to see how different we are from what we were 120 years ago, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I find that really eerie. I find it a really frightening thought that the world is kind of going wrong in an accelerated way. I find that really unnerving. I sort of have to in the sand a little bit.
I know. It makes me wonder, though, like in, you know, in the late 19th century when industrialization was happening, were people saying the same thing? The world is accelerating so quickly and it's all going to fall apart by 1920 or something. And like, I wonder if every generation feels like Chicken Little, like the sky is falling, the sky is falling, you know? And I mean, that's what I hope.
Yeah, I hope so. Because if not, then it, wow.
I know. If not, that's a scary part of that, man.
Oh, let's talk about people with machetes. It's less unnerving. Franchises. This has kind of become one in a way. And how do you keep a conceit like this fresh in a third installment, Stephen?
Oh, man. Well, you've got to keep surprising the audience. You've got to both deliver the goods you delivered the first time, the second time, but you've also got to deliver them in such a way that they can be ambushed by where it all ends up, you know? And so that was what I had to do with Angel of Indian Lake, or I had to try to do. I mean, I won't know for months and months, maybe ever, if I actually pulled it off. But that was what I felt I had to do anyways. And but I love that. Like I was saying earlier, I love that pressure. I love the idea that I've got to do the same, but different and surprising, you know? Like we never like those series or franchises where the variables are just changed, but it's the same exact story. But those kind of get kind of stale. So I didn't want to fall into that trap. And I may have fallen into that trap if I were doing 12 books on this, because I think that would start to verge into the, what's it called? The Cabot Cove problem, like the Murder, She Wrote problem, where how can this little town of like 2,000 people have a murder every week? You know, that's kind of pushing our ability to suspend our disbelief. And like, I think even with 3 slasher cycles coming to Proof Rock, I think I'm teetering on the edge of how can this happen 3 times, you know? So if I were doing it a 4th time, I think that would probably be too much. I think I can, if I did everything just right, I can maybe get away with it 3 times.
Well, you have got away with it, because one of the questions I wrote early on before I read the book was, how are you going to sustain the reality of this situation? And then what I think you do very smartly is you confront that question in the book, that Jade is almost incredulous that this could be happening again. And I think that in some way offsets, it answers the question before it's asked, if you know what I mean.
Hopefully.
But here's a sort of meta question, because I simply don't know enough about slashers to know. Is there some element typical to a third installment in a franchise that you were trying to capture here?
You know, it's basically Randy's rules that he kind of outlines in on video in the third installment of Scream. You know, it's got to be like the kills are even bloodier and bigger, more a higher body count. Anyone can die. And that person you thought was dead may not be as gone as we thought, you know? And anyone can be the slasher. That's probably what I landed on the best. It can be anybody. Mm-hmm. But what you also have to do in a third installment is considerably escalate the stakes. The stakes can't just be my survival. And in the case of this third installment, it's the survival of Proof Rock itself, this whole community that Jade is fighting for. And now that she's fought for the community, if I were doing a fourth book, she'd have to fight for Idaho. And then the next, it would be the North American continent. And then it would probably get carried away. You know, so I'm kind of lucky I'm stopping at three. Man.
Jade in space.
Yeah, exactly. Jade, yeah, that she could find Jason after he jumps out of that ship and X, you know, that'd be fun.
But those stakes, right, they may go to all of Proof Rock, but they all concentrate on this mm-hmm. little girl, don't they? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Letha's little girl.
Yeah.
Which I think was a really clever move, because it's kind of like Aliens with Newt. Suddenly you don't just care about Sigourney and Ripley staying alive, you know. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that Jade's arc can be summed up in one sentence that I highlighted, that she says, "I used to be all about the final girl, standing on top of a pile of the dead. Now I'm all about holding the door of the slasher-proof shelter open so everyone can duck inside and ride this night out." Mm-hmm. That feels like the culmination of Jade's journey. That it's like her opening herself up to humanity, and this like kind of solipsistic referential thing is not as necessary because she understands human beings a bit better.
Yeah, no, I totally like that. Did I write that? That's an Angel?
Yeah, yeah, you wrote that. Wow. Yeah. It's on page 221 of my edition.
I never remembered the stuff I write. That's terrible. You know, I was on social media once and somebody had a stack of books they were going to give away. And the way they were going to give it away was they said, guess what book this is the first line of. So they posted that book, that line. And I was in there. I wanted those books. So I'm like, is it this book? Is it that book? And this person kept DMing me around the side and saying, you've got to quit doing this. You're messing it up. And I was like, well, I don't want to play your stupid game anyway. And so I quit. And then it turns out it was one of my lines of my books, you know, that I had opened with. And I just don't remember the stuff I write. But I like that. I think you're right. That does serve as a thesis statement for Jade's journey. I'm lucky that that's in the book, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it is. Yeah. So most people would have kept quiet there and just gone and go, yeah, 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 and come up with some bullshit about, you know, the deeper meanings. But no, yeah, you wrote it. Let's see what else you remember, or if it's even occurred to you. So something that occurred to me anyway, and I don't even know if this is true. But each of these books, Chainsaw, Reaper, Indian Lake, is framed by a different element, I suppose. So mm-hmm. to me, Chainsaw is all about the lake. It's all about water. Mm-hmm. Reaper mm-hmm. is snow and ice. And now in this one, there's this huge forest fire.
Yep. Yep.
Is that an intentional symbolic thing, or am I talking bullshit?
No, I mean, I wish I could say it was strategic, that I had like tactically deployed these different elements, like I'm Avatar the Last Airbender or something, but I don't have those planning abilities. So I knew that the first one was largely about the lake. Like I knew that after I wrote it, I didn't plan it. But, and so then I thought, well, for the second one to have any juice, I've got to deny myself the juice of the first one. And so I said, no more lake water. It's going to be frozen. And so that's kind of why everything is snowy and why I brought that big blizzard up the mountain in Idaho. And then in the third one, it was October. I knew I wanted to land this story on Halloween, just kind of to honor, you know, John Carpenter and Deborah Hill. But, and so because winter with global warming seems to be coming later and later, I couldn't really fake a big snowfall in Idaho in October. And I also couldn't do the same thing I'd done in Reaper. And I thought that starting a fire would be especially scary for Jade, because there was a little fire that pops up in chainsaw, and so I thought that if I spark a fire up across the lake, then she is gonna have that moment of instability where she feels like this is all happening again, and that's her big like arc for the first third of the book. This can't be happening. And so for me, throwing that fire up was just another signal to Jade that I'm being pulled back in when I don't want to be pulled back in, because she thinks she's graduated from this stuff. She doesn't want to have to do it anymore. But here's that fire, and it's going to burn not just Proof Rock, it's going to burn a big chunk of Idaho if it's not put down. So yeah, I wish I was strategic. I wish I had thought through stuff like water, ice, and fire, and I'm glad it works out. But no, I never plan stuff. It just kind of happens.
Yeah, I find it mad that you don't plan stuff, because it's like the most intricate pulling together of strands, this final book. And then I read in the afterword, you said, oh, I don't plan, I just write and kind of stumble my way to a hopeful ending. It seems insane to me, because there are so many moving parts throughout the entire trilogy. I mean, I know you like your history, actually, because like, you know, the motivation for the crimes in Reaper was to do with a genuine kind of atrocity back in the day. Did you know that Idaho was the site of the worst ever American forest fire?
No, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Back in 1910, like the Great Idaho Fire was like supposedly on record as the worst American forest fire ever.
Huh. Wow. And you know, also I didn't even think about this, but I think between Reaper and Angel, we had a really big fire here and where I live in Boulder. And it actually started in a town kind of in these two towns, Superior and Louisville, which are adjacent to Boulder. And I happened to be over in Louisville having lunch, and across the parking lot, there were flames taller than buildings, and we're sitting there eating our stuff and watching those flames. And the staff of the restaurant is all out the window watching the flames. And, I was just trying to get my food in because I thought surely we can outrun a fire, but it got pretty touch and go there for a bit. We paid our bill and we had to run and get out of there. So I wonder if that's not why the fire was like more palpably real or visceral to me for Angel. You know, I don't know. It burned, I don't know how many houses. It burned a lot of stuff around here.
God, I see. We don't have to contend with that over here yet. I mean, it's probably coming the way the world is going. But I was in Canada in the Pacific Northwest one summer, and no, I was in the Rockies rather. And I saw the smoke from the fires come across the highway. And I've never seen, I mean, you read about this stuff, but I've never seen anything like that. So thinking about, you know, living cheek by jowl with these fires in the summer, it's just terrifying to imagine.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Well, you know, I was in Spain maybe two years ago on a train going across Spain from, where was it, Avilas to Madrid, I guess, something like that. And that was when the fires were happening there. And so from the train windows, we were all just watching these massive fires out there. It was terrifying and weird, you know?
Yeah. Well, it does prompt a lot of action. And this, well, there's tons of action in this book, because from about page 150, it's essentially one long undulating chase sequence. It's like a relay of chase where different people are chasing Jade. But it's also a very interior novel. Because despite what's going on, we spend a lot of time in Jade's head. Right. Sorry about the length of this question, but I want to. It's something I've struggled to articulate. I'm always struck by how you balance those two things, action and introspection, because you've done it in all three of these books. You did it in Only Good Indians. You write these really fast-paced events, but you slow them right down to treacle sometimes by having Jade really think through every moment. And I'm thinking in particular of a scene in which an axe is kind of heading for Jade's head. And it takes about four pages to get there, because she's reflecting on everything and reframing it through cinema and through memory. And so these really fast scenes end up taking 100 pages. And it gives your books just this unique pacing that I've never read elsewhere.
Well, thank you. I don't know if I have any special powers as far as fiction goes, but I did realize really early on that, like probably when I was 22, maybe right around there, I realized that I could put a foot pump on a scene and dilate it out, if that makes sense. And And that was a space in which I could operate more effectively than I could in other spaces, if that makes sense. Maybe, you know, but to tell you the truth, me doing what you're talking about could be a retreat, because the hardest parts of novels for me to write are the boring parts, you know, like I'm at work for an 8-hour shift and I'm just sitting here on a spreadsheet or whatever it is. I don't know how writers write the boring parts and keep them interesting. they do it, but I don't have that ability to make the boring parts interesting. But I also understand that one of the special provinces of fiction is having access to the interior lives of our characters. And so therefore I kind of have to stage those little glimpses into the heads of these people during action scenes, because I don't have the ability to write the boring scenes. There's always got to be like, we're on a roller coaster and six of the wheels have fallen off and we're about to die. Meanwhile, I'm thinking about this, you know, that's the only way I know how to do it, I think, man.
Yeah. It just makes for a really properly immersive reading experience. And it can be frustrating at first. I always describe reading your books as like the time when I first got into Charles Dickens, where there's the first book I read by Dickens, I was like, this fucking, the sentences are like the length of a page, you know, like what? And then you kind of just sort of, it clicks. You just get into the pace and the idiom and the tonality and the cadence of it all. And suddenly you realize you're no longer deciphering these sentences. You're just reading them. And I feel the same about your books.
Oh, thank you. You know, there's a lot of writers you read, like sometimes John Barth. You've read all these dudes, John Barth or Gaddis or Pynchon, where the model I always use to explain it is reading those books is like walking out onto a frozen lake, and you know there's this whole body of water with fish and trash and plants under you that you want to go to, but you have to keep walking across that ice, and finally you get out far enough that you fall through and you're in that wonderful world, but you have to endure a little bit of cold and you have to jump up and down on the ice to get through. You know, that's what, to me, that's the point at which a novel's got me, is when I fall through that ice finally and I'm under there and the only thing I can breathe is what the writer gives me, you know, and I love being in that space. Sometimes there's a little bit of a, I'm framing it terribly. It's a grueling walk across the ice, you know. You should put ladders at the front of your books, not walls, I feel like. But at the same time, a little bit, I appreciate what Umberto Eco says about the first 100 pages of The Name of the Rose, where people always take into task. They're like, all you're doing is laying out the blueprint of this monastery that these characters are in, this abbey. Maybe it's an abbey. And Umberto Eco would say, yeah, but that's the fire you have to walk through to get to the story. And I don't think you should put a fire at the front of your book, don't get me wrong, but I do love getting to the other side of it. You know, I love being in that abbey that Umberto Eco has so beautifully and wonderfully detailed out for me, you know. And there's always that moment, like one of the first movements that haunted house novels make is they have the real estate agent, the caretaker, whoever it is, they have them walk this crew through the layout of this house. You know, here's a pantry, here's the stairs, here's a basement, don't go in this room, all that stuff. And what that's doing is preparing us, the readers, for when this or that character has to run through this space, that it's already a real space they're running through, you know? And I don't want to do that too much in my books. I don't want to slow things down. Again, I want to put ladders at the front of books, not walls or fires or big walks of ice. But I do like being in a space that makes sense too.
Have you ever read Andy Davidson's The Hollow Kind?
The Hollow Kind. I read Valley of the Sun. The Hollow Kind is not that one that it's real green and leafy. Is that the one?
Probably is, yeah. It's the one about the house with the evil tree and the in the forest and stuff. And because it just makes everything you said made me think about that, about Umberto Eco and The Name of the Rose. Because the first 50 pages of that book are the densest architectural detail about this house, and I was kind of like, "Whoa, what?" And then, as you just say, later on, it makes sense to have this innate knowledge about how this house works. But it's quite a gamble, right?
It is a gamble, like but it pays off a lot, like Susanna Clarke in Piranesi. That's what she does for the first movement of that novel.
I haven't read that yet.
Well, she's just laying out the impossible, fantastical architecture inside this house, you know? And she says in interviews or somewhere that she's heard that most of her readers would have been completely happy to just keep reading that. They don't need the plot, the characters, the adventure. They just want to read about what's in this room, what's in that room, what's down that hall, you know?
Whereas I'm guessing your crazy non-Euclidean geometry isn't so much space as the inside of Jade's head, right?
That's a good way to say it. Yeah, that's a good way to say that. I had not thought of it like that. I like that a lot. I think you're right, too, because Jade, it is her her tangential way of thinking that takes a little bit to fall in step with, I feel like, you know?
Even at like a grammatical level, we've said this before, you and I, about how you don't really worry too much about following the grammar of prose. You follow the grammar of conversation and thought, don't you? Certainly in these books you do anyway.
Yeah, I do, yeah. But at the same time, how do you say it? Like, is this Charles Wright, the poet? It could be. I think there's one called James Wright, too. I always get them confused. There's a poet who says, you can't write free verse until you know form, you know? And so yeah. I feel the same way about grammar and punctuation and syntax. You can't jack with that stuff until you know how it should be, you know?
Yeah.
And
know the rules to break them, that sort of thing.
Exactly. So if I'm going to not punctuate a restrictive clause the way it's always been punctuated, then I need to know that I'm doing that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I do in this book and also in Teen Slasher, play with like specifically restrictive clauses in a different way. But I would never do something like putting a dependent clause after a semicolon. Like there are certain rules that I consider sacrosanct that I just don't have the nerve to bust open, you know? But I should say also, I spent a year in grad school working on my master's where I made the decision for myself that I was beyond punctuation. And so everything I turned in had no capital letters, no periods, no paragraph breaks. And that was completely insufferable. I can't imagine how my professors put up with me, but I'm glad they did, because writing for a year without any punctuation taught me how to punctuate with syntax, with word order, with word choice. And I think that has, if there's been a single like catalyzing moment in my whole writing career where I learned the most, I think that's it. That's where my rhythm kind of changed and became its own thing, for better or worse. I'm not saying everybody has to like it or anything. It could be totally stupid, but that's where I feel like I became who I am now.
When were you in grad school?
Oh, let's see. I went my master's, I went in 94. I was out by 96. And then my PhD, I went in 96 and I was done with that by 98.
Fine. So you had an excuse because you were there in the era when everyone was fucking around with like grammar and syntax. Yeah. You could just say like, hey, I'm just part of the zeitgeist.
Exactly. You had Gordon Lish. He did like two novels at the time with no punctuation. And I read those and I was like, this is how it should be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, once people have got, you know, in tune with Jade's way of thinking, you lock them there in this book, because after widening the perspective in Don't Fear the Reaper, you've recentered this final volume mm-hmm. with a really tight focus on Jade. Was mm-hmm. that a conscious decision you made? Because Letha's not even in Proof Rock for yeah. so much of the book.
It kind of was, because, you know, in My Heart is a Chainsaw, we're really, like, Jade's our focal character. We're right over her shoulder. A lot of people seem to remember Chainsaw as Jade was the narrator, which I think is wonderful and cool and amazing. But I knew that because Chainsaw was so fixated on Jade and her, it was locked in her perception. For Reaper, I felt obligated to widen that, to make it kind of multivocal so we could get a sense of the community, of the other people, the other players. But that also set up the third book, Angel. It said, in the second book, you're kind of supposed to miss Jade because she's not doing her essays anymore for Mr. Holmes, and she only has one part of each of the chapters. But that was a little strategic, I guess. I say I don't plan things. I did a little bit plan this. I wanted the reader to miss Jade and Reaper such that when she came on as the narrator, the first person narrator in Angel, it could be like a homecoming, like a return, you know? Mm-hmm. And And it was really fun. And probably the most fun part of doing Angel was the contrast between how Jade presents herself in her chapters, which is like 90% of the book at least, yeah, and how she is portrayed in the Baker Solutions investigative reports that are, you know, interspersed through it.
Yeah, because I had to struggle for a while to work out what they were about, and then I remembered what the name Baker related to.
Yeah.
And then I got the sense of that they provide a completely different perspective, don't they? Which is kind of derogatory in a different way, because Jade is quite derogatory about herself. She takes so much on herself. She's to blame for everything. She's sort of almost wants to sacrifice herself to redeem things. Mm-hmm. But she has a quite epic register about things, whereas those Baker reports really bring it down to a much more sort of pathetic level, don't they?
Yeah, that was really fun. Like, one of the Baker reports talks about how she chained herself to a cabin over at Camp Blood. But she does it on, like, Easter Sunday, so nobody's even there, you know?
Yeah.
But the other thing that really gives a different perspective, and I thought it was one of the most affecting parts of the book, and it's three pages, is in one of the Baker reports, they include a letter that Jade writes to Mr. Holmes. And that is written with very little punctuation. So maybe this was you channeling yourself in the 90s. That's just so raw with emotion. So raw. And the way she writes about her mum, this is the first part where I start to get a bit emotional, where she says, "I'll never let go. She'll never give in because of those memos Letha's going to send. And because my mum threw a purse at a giant she could never kill one day when it was cold that it had ever been." And of course, as we know in Reaper, her mum kind of tried to save her. And you kind of lay bare that this 95% of narrative that we get from Jade, where she's hard and tough, mellowed slightly, but still seeing things through very much a sort of the mindset you set up. Those three pages kind of undermine all of that and reveal that she's a much more emotional creature than we think she is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's all heart. That's kind of what I like about Jade, is that she's all heart, but she tries to armor herself up and disguise herself with all these references and all this toughness and everything. She wants to flip the world off, but she would never admit that she also wants to hug it, you know? But that letter she writes, it's right after, it's a pretty traumatic night for her, I guess I should say. I don't want to give anything away. Yeah, she doesn't have any filters, you know, and she's also writing to someone who's never going to receive this letter, so she can be brutally honest, because she's basically writing to herself. She's got to know that at some level. And yeah, it's typo laden, wrong punctuation and stuff. And I don't want to say that Jade can't write better than that. She can write better than that. She's a teacher now, but it's 3 a.m. or something, and she's just suffered something pretty traumatic. And she's also on some stuff. So it was fun to kind of dial back to her slasher 101 diction just for those three pages. That was really fun for me. And it was really tricky too, because there's also a point where she writes a more formal essay in another Baker Solutions investigative report that is more for public consumption. And so those three pieces had to all be, I mean, those two pieces and then Jade's narration throughout the book are all from Jade, but they're from Jade in different stages and with different audiences. And so I had to rig her writing and her relaying her story in different but recognizable ways, which was a tall order, but it was really fun. I love it when Jade takes the pen. Those are the best moments of Chainsaw to me.
Well, it was cool reading those different voices from Jade, because it reminded me of something that should have been patently obvious, that this is Jade's voice and not your voice, because it's so comprehensive. And I think because you and I have only spoken about these three books, I just keep falling into this trap of thinking that, you know, this is your voice and you happen to be writing about Jade, and then seeing those different tones, which realize, oh no, this is all craft. All of this is craft. It's not just Stephen writing his thoughts on slashes down on the page. But you said something a minute ago about Jade having a traumatic night. There is a very different traumatic night in this, and I'm not going to give any spoilers away, because to do so would be criminal. Mm-hmm. You kill some people in this book, Stephen, and we shouldn't talk details, but you kill some people that I can't believe you killed.
Man, me neither. I didn't want to do it, but
so that's, right, that's there, like, you go. You didn't want to do it, but you did it. Like, talk me through that.
You know, I mean, I just feel like in a horror novel, if you get to the end of it and the deck crew is still all there patting each other on the back, we made it through another one, you know, then I think you've failed. I don't think you've pushed yourself as hard as – you don't think you've pushed the story as hard as you can push it. For a horror story to actually have real stakes, then people who shouldn't die have to die, you know. And this is probably a lesson I learned. There's a movie called Feast. I don't know if you know that movie or not. It's got to be from 20 years ago, it feels like, already. I'm not sure. But it's a monster movie, and it's a little bit comedy too. And at the very first of that movie, it's doing that thing. It feels like a Trainspotting thing. It also feels like a Quentin Tarantino thing, but where when each new character walks on screen, it's a freeze frame and they get a little like a subtitle, like,
It's like a Guy Ritchie type thing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's like the bruiser or the big crime boss or whatever. It gives a little spiel about him. And this feast is doing that. And then it gets to this little kid up, this 10-year-old kid upstairs in a wheelchair. And it says, this kid is obviously invulnerable. He will live through any story. We can't kill him. And then almost immediately a big monster comes through the window and just slaughters that kid, you know? And that to me pushed me into a space where anything can happen. And I think vital characters, meeting their end in horror stories pulls the reader into a space where anything can happen. And that to me is when horror novels come alive the best, is when anything can happen. And I think that's probably why George Martin's Ice and Fire series has been so effective, because, I mean, people we invest in and we think they're going to make it through to the end of the series don't. And that pushes us into good spaces story-wise.
And by God, hasn't everyone copied that since?
Yeah, I guess so.
Like, I am, because I agree with you. Me and my wife constantly talk about what one day, Steve, I'm going to have to put her on the phone with you, because you can explain it better than me. My wife just cannot get beyond this thing about, like, if a story has a downbeat ending, what's the point of it? So I made her watch The Mist the other day, and I didn't tell her the ending, and things did not go well. But her point is not that it's scary. It's like, what's the point of it? And I always say that the point is to make you feel, and bad feelings can be good storytelling. And my defense for horror is it's some degree fantasy, but my defense is it's the one genre where you shouldn't ever feel secure in your expectations.
No, I totally agree. And like, I also, like your wife, I prefer redemption at the end. I prefer like a payback of my investment of time and energy and heart and everything. But horror is not at all compelled to provide a happy or uplifting ending. And even an ending like The Mist, you know, The Mist ends like, it's one of the most downbeat endings of all. I love it myself, but it's very, very downbeat. It's a sad ending for that dude, but it's also a happy ending, you know, because the military or whoever has figured out a way to put this bad stuff down. On the individual level, it's bad, but it's not bad for the world, I don't think, you know? And with my own novels, like, I can't do an upending every time. I have to, every once in a while, do that kind of ending that's a little bit bad. And I say a little bit bad in the sense of, like, what is it, Tale of Two Cities with Sidney Carton going to the gallows in place of someone else, sacrificing himself. Like, somebody we have invested in and want to live is dying, but it's also a form of redemption, you know? And I love happy endings, but I think what I love within the happy ending, like, I don't know, category, is a qualified happy ending, maybe a Pyrrhic victory, you know?
Yeah, I like a happy ending, but a happy ending means more if there was the chance of an unhappy ending.
For sure, 100%, man, yeah.
I keep coming back to this afterword because it's such a... It's worth the price of the book on its own, Stephen, this afterword. And in it, you say that this book, in particular, showed you what your strengths and your weaknesses are. So I've got to ask, what have you found them to be?
Yeah, that's a good question. I forgot I wrote that. I should have been ready to answer it. I think if I have a strength on the page, it's believing in luck. You know, foolish. I think it's foolishly believing in luck, but that's the only thing I've ever found that's worthwhile to subscribe to as far as writing fiction. I don't think that my craft or technique or experience, any of that actually is what gets these stories to come together. I think it's just that I know I can juggle three balls, but for a novel, I try to juggle 16 balls. And for the span of 300 pages, 400 pages, I can maybe keep those balls going, you know, and it's just complete luck. It's my hands going faster by instinct than I can tell them to go, you know? And yeah, so, I mean, that's a stupid thing to say that luck is my secret power. But if I have if I have anything, then I think it's luck. That's all I've got. But like all the basketball players say, the harder you work, the luckier you get. You know, I agree with that as well. My weaknesses, those are manifold. Those are quite everywhere. You know, I'm really jealous, envious of how like James Patterson, Dan Brown, or Chuck Wendig. I don't mean to class Wendig with Patterson or Brown, because I know a lot of people don't like Patterson and Brown's writing. But they all are able to give a story propulsion with these super short digestible chapters, you know, and that just do a single thing instead of trying to do everything at once. Mm-hmm. And I'm really fascinated and compelled by being able to tell a story like that. And I would love to learn how to do it.
Why have interest?
I just like stories to hit the ground and absolutely sprint. And I think stories sprint better when each chapter is about 3 or 4 pages long.
Ah, this is the one place we're going to disagree, I think, because funnily enough, when I was reading Angel, like there are these little, because there's a nice sort of claw design at the start of each section. Mm-hmm. I could, when you look at the pages, when you close the book, look at the pages, you can see the kind of gray line at the start of each chapter, you know, and there are a serious number of pages between, you know, section breaks. And at first I was like, oh God, because you don't really give us, it's just, there's not even like section breaks within that. It's just a lot of prose. I found it captivating. I don't like the short chapter thing as a rule. To me, it feels like a book with all the bits that, all the unnecessary bits that you actually love left out. You know, I know you said you don't like writing boring bits, but I like what you do in this, like the segues and the random interludes and, oh, we'll go down this thought path. Whereas if you were just like stripping it down to, right, this event happens and then next chapter, it's a different day or he's in a different place or a different, I find it cheats me of the stuff that often makes me care about the story. Obviously, there are many exceptions to this.
Yeah. No, I also, you know, when I read, I don't mind super long chapters myself. I just, when I'm reading those short chapters, I'm like, wow, I am digesting these dudes fast. This is like I'm eating an appetizer plate, you know, and I just can't stop doing it. There's somebody put a lot of fried zucchini in front of me and I'm going to eat the whole basket really, really fast, you know? But I do think that long chapters, to me, kind of, I don't know, inhabit, express, recapitulate what I think is the essential power of fiction, which is to transform or transmute things into other things, you know? And so when you talk about in a long chapter, we were doing this and now somehow we're doing that. And there was a little bit of integuum, like a little bit of connective tissue between that, which kind of makes it make sense. I do think that's a special power of fiction, that it can do that. And I am really, really romantically attached to that special power, which is probably why my chapters tend to be on the longer side, you know?
Do you kind of lose yourself when you're writing?
Oh, that's the only way I know to write. My study used to be at the end of a long hall, and I would always have to set up these little baffles and stuff in the hallway such that any person or dog that came down to my study was going to have to make noise to get there, because I get so deep in the novel that if somebody is suddenly standing behind me and says, hey, then I'm going to jump out of my skin. You know, it's not just when I'm writing scary stuff. It's that I am so completely in the world that I'm writing that I forget there's another world. I think this is the real world. And that's the only way I've ever known to do it. Like, I know some writers are kind of like puppet masters or chess players, where they are manipulating every little thing on the page and saying this will be good for that. And I never have been able to do that. I don't. Mm. It's not that I can't conceptualize it. It's that it's not real to me. I'm above it. I can't be above it. I have to be in it.
And well, and that comes across massively in these books, because I said this to you last time, that reading these three books in particular, with this just endless unrolling propulsion, it puts me in mind of that old story about Kerouac, you know, when he just fed, when he wrote On the Road and took all the mescaline and then fed that roll of paper into his typewriter and just kept typing.
Yeah.
That's how it feels to read this, that you've just typed and then the story's poured out of you.
Thank you. That's exactly, I think that's exactly what I'm going for. And I've always been like romantically fascinated with that big scroll of paper that he wrote On the Road with too. But now we all have endless digital scrolls of paper in our screens. And so maybe we're all Kerouac, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a heartening thought. final few questions before we stop, Stephen. This is a question you're going to be asked a million times. So I'm hoping to ask it now before you get jaded with the answer. How are you feeling about letting this story end and these characters go?
Oh man, that's neat that you said jaded to the answer too. oh, it hurts, man. It makes me understand Lord of the Rings better, actually, because Lord of the Rings ends forever. You know, like Frodo throws that ring into the Mordor lava or whatever, Gollum in the ring going to the lava, anyways, and then the story just keeps on ending and keeps on ending. And I'm like, how is this happening? The dramatic line is over. But now that I've done a trilogy, I kind of understand where Tolkien was coming from, that he has been in this world. He's been in Middle Earth so long, hanging out with these amazing, bigger than life characters, that he wants to hang out with them a little bit more, you know? And I also had that impulse. I wanted to hang out with Jade more. I wanted to do a little flash forward of, look, here's Jade in 20 years and stuff like that. But I finally decided that I would be indulging myself at the reader's expense, at the story's expense. You know, I think the job of a writer in a novel and a story and any piece of fiction is you throw this big, loud party. Everybody's having a great time. And when the party is at its biggest and loudest and best, you slip out the side door and let the party keep on going without you. And I think that's what I had to try to do in Angel of Indian Lake. I had to sneak out the side door while things were still happening.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. Yeah, I'm going to say something I have no right to say, but if ever someone comes to you with $1 million and says, write a fourth book, don't do it, Stephen, because you've literally... You've stepped away and left this thing behind that just works, you know? No one needed a Toy Story 4. No one needed it. You know what I mean? And you've written Horror's Toy Story. So leave it. It's close to perfect. You know what I mean? So,
Thank you. I'll try to remember that. And you know, my model for resisting that type of like enticing appeal is Will Ferrell. Like, they came to him with what, like $16 million? They said, let's do Elf 2. And he said, no, Elf 1 was enough. And I think that's the honorable way to be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. $1 million is a lot of money, Stephen. Do what the hell you want. but you probably can't answer this, but I'm going to ask anyway. Is Stephen King really voicing somebody in the audiobook?
He really is, yeah, and it's so exciting. I think people are going to be so satisfied with...
So you can't tell us who it is?
I can't. I don't think I'm released yet to say who it is. But
okay.
Yeah, I'm really, really... It's such an honor to have Stephen King be part of the production of this. That means everything, you know? Yeah, Barbara Crampton is... I can't tell you what she's doing either, but just having her involved, wow, you know? And
yeah, I mean, she's an icon, right? Wow, Barbara Crampton. Yeah. That's like, that is like the king and queen of horror. That's royalty.
I know. It's amazing, man. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Congrats.
Thank you.
And my last question is something that will make no sense to anybody who's not yet read this book, but have you had any luck at tracking down the poem about the buffalo?
Oh, yeah. It's now in later editions of Angel of Indian Lake, like when it does... more printings, and it's probably going to be in the ebook as well. A reader who read the early edition of Angel of Indian Lake did manage to find that poem for me, the Buffalo poem, and I'm so thrilled to have it. And they told me where it's from and everything. So yeah, and that person who told me is now in the acknowledgements as well.
Amazing. Can I ask, when we finish, will you drop me an email where it is? Because it moved me so deeply. I mean, mm-hmm. Do you know it off by heart?
I don't know, and I don't get it quite right in the novel either. But I mean, who's going to get it? I mean, it's not about me not getting it right. It's about Jade not getting it right. And who's going to remember the exact wording of a poem that you heard, you know, a year ago or whatever?
I've written down your version of it, and it got me. And the idea is that it's a poem, and the title of the poem is this: upon reading that three buffalo escaped their train car in some town, New Mexico, and went running down Main Street, tearing up this and that and whatever. That's the title. And the poem just says, run on, brothers.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, like a punch to the heart, that. It is so... I'm so glad you found it, because I was trawling the net, typing in every possible permutation I could to try and find that poem. So I'm glad it's been found.
It has. Yeah. I was just trying to stealthily look in my inbox so I could read it to you. But the fact that I've already written the Buffalo Hunter, that vampire novel, has completely polluted my inbox, because I can't search Buffalo anymore because it's got 5,000 messages.
That's fine. If you can let me know, I'll put it on the show notes or whatever.
Please do.
It's a beautiful idea, stylistic idea for a poem. Yeah, it's lovely. Which brings us to the final two questions. So we've talked about a lot of books today, Stephen, but can you recommend a book that you think my listeners should read and tell us why?
You bet. Actually, in one of your previous podcasts, I forget who you were talking with, maybe Gwendolyn. I think you were talking with Gwendolyn about David Lynch. And
yes.
And I realized that you might, this is just a recommendation only for you. I mean, it's a great book. Everybody should read it, but I think you'll get a lot out of this. Slavoj Zizek's The Art of the Ridiculous Sublime. It's about David Lynch's Lost Highway. It's a little monograph. Okay. That has been one of the most important books for my, I don't know, artistic development. That sounds all puffy when I say it, but just for me understanding how story and fiction and art can work, Slavoj Zizek's The Art of the Ridiculous Sublime on David Lynch's Lost Highway is something I return to again and again, because it just is so productive, so insightful, so amazing. I'll never stop reading that book. For everyone else, I'm not saying everyone can't read that book. I'm just saying I think you'll have a particular fascination with it. You know, there's a book that I think it's just now out, Catherine Arden's The Warm Hands of Ghosts. That book blows me away. Like, Catherine Arden did the Winter Night trilogy a few years ago. It starts out with The Bear and the Nightingale. And that trilogy, to me, was the best fantasy trilogy I had read since probably Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials, you know? And cool. I think the best trilogy I've read since that is Rebecca Roanhorse's Between Earth and Sky, which ends with Mirrored Heavens, which is completely amazing. But Catherine Arden's The Warm Hands of Ghosts. And, you know, it's set. Where is it?
It's like an Edwardian thing, right?
Well, no, The Warm Hands of Ghosts is set in World War One, and it's historical fantasy, but it's not like elves and orcs kind of fantasy. It's a different kind of fantasy. But Catherine Arden, she is just such a competent storyteller. She knows completely what she's doing. When you're in her hands on the page, you're in a good, productive space, and she just knows how to do things. It's really nice to lose yourself in the words and the world of a competent writer, you know?
Okay. I love anything set during the First World War, anything speculative. And I've never read anything by her. So I will, unlike my normal promises to look things up, which are completely false, I will actually track that one down, because that sounds fantastic.
It is. And she does her research. It's historic. It's kind of like an Amakatsu level of research, you know, or historical accuracy is maybe what I should say, you know, and it just is completely compelling. Like the World War One that she renders on the page in The Warm Hands of Ghost is now the World War One I subscribe to, because it feels so palpably real, you know?
Okay. Well, yeah, count me in. That sounds fantastic. What I'd say to you in return, if you like that, and obviously I haven't read that, so I can't possibly say that this is similar or not, but a book I read last year that blew me away out of nowhere was a book called The Others of Edenwell by Verity Holloway, who's published by Titan. She came on the show. And that, again, is it's set in the First World War, but it's set in a recuperation hospital in the UK that has strange things going on in its surrounds.
I love hospital horror, man. For some reason, it's so... I mean, I think hospitals are just places of... they're not bad places, like Stephen King defines a bad place. They can be, of course, but they're just places of intense feelings, you know? Like everything is
intense
heightened.
Feelings. Yeah, that is what this book, Others Have Eaten Well, I described it as if E.M. Forster had written Pet Sematary.
Oh, so, wow. Oh, that's amazing. That's a good way to explain a thing.
It's odd, and it's never quite what you think it's going to be. I think from what you said about The Warm Hands of a Ghost, I think you might like it. So, and listeners, have at it.
Great. That's a great, thank you. I will definitely look that up. And The Warm Hands of Ghosts actually happens a lot in these same hospitals.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. Cool. Thank you. That's an actual recommendation. I promise I will try and try it. I've got holidays soon, so I can read that. I've promised the listener to the show, Mark, he sent a guy called Mark Lynch, who listens to the show, sent me a big box of all the books I've said I want to read over the years. And he sent them, including Mythical Wood, which I've never read. Okay. So that's the kind of Edwardian thing as well. So I'm going to read both of those on holiday. That's my promise to you and to Mark. Nice. But my last question, Stephen. What is the last thing that properly scared you?
Yeah, it's weirdly enough, I was on a dissertation committee, and this student's dissertation scared me terribly. and not because it was poorly done, it was wonderfully done. And I can't mention her name or the particulars, you know, because there's all these restrictions about stuff like that. But it's a dissertation about ghosts. That's why I got on this committee, because I wanted to learn some stuff, and I did learn some stuff about the taxonomy, the various taxonomies of types of ghosts and everything. It was quite interesting. But one story that gets relayed in this is how the cleaning staff of this certain public space, who are working after hours and deep in the morning, sometimes sees a person go into the restroom, and they assume it's, you know, another staff member or someone working late. But then while they're mopping that hallway for 30 minutes or something, that person never comes out, and they go in to investigate, and there's nobody there. And I get chills right now while I'm telling you this. I'm getting scared. That is so frightening to me. What's frightening, the most frightening ghosts to me are not the ghosts who say, I was murdered 6 years ago, you gotta solve my crime, or any of that stuff. That to me is always kind of ridiculous. But the ghosts that scare me are the ones who don't care about me, you know, the ones who are just moving and doing their own thing. And that just puts me off completely. And I was in my study when I read that portion of the dissertation. It was about 11, 12 at night. And I still had to go up a set of stairways and turn off all the lights in the house and get to the bedroom. And that was an arduous enterprise, let me tell you. There was a lot of jumping and flinching and hiding against the wall, and it was quite embarrassing. It would have been its own stupid short film, I think. But and that infected me for a few days after. I couldn't get to my bed without it being a complete hilarious, stupid adventure of how do I turn this light off? How do I get to this hall? How do I walk past that open doorway? All that stuff. Because what if there's a ghost? You know, it terrifies me so much.
Stephen, would you like me to upset you with a ghost story?
Oh, I guess. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what, listeners? I've told this story before on the air. So if you've heard this before about my mother in the hospital, skip forward sort of 2 or 3 minutes to the outro. If you haven't heard it before, if this is your first time listening or the first time in a while, enjoy this. This is me going to upset Stephen because it's very similar. I'll keep it brief because I've told it before. My mother worked in a really old kind of Victorian psychiatric hospital in the north of England as a nurse for years. And there were lots of some dangerous people in this hospital. And there was a whole separate wing for dangerous people. And it was often unoccupied because it was for really high security, you know. But to clean it, my mother and another nurse had to go through a door that was locked, lock it behind them, go through another door that was locked, lock that behind them, walk up some stairs into the basically the ward where there were, as my mother describes it, six rooms on one side and six rooms on the other side. and it would be emptied by this point if they were cleaning it. And my mother and her companion would walk around and open every door to make sure there was no one up there. So all the doors would be open, and all the doors up there were open, all the doors back down the stairs were locked, and they would then one by one clean the rooms. And they went in the first room, and as they were in there, they heard every other door slam in sequence.
Oh, wow.
They went back out, man. Opened all the doors. There was no one there. The door was still locked. They went back in a different room to clean it. All the doors slammed in sequence. So they got out of there quick. And then years later, when my mother had been promoted to, like, I don't know the terminology, but like a more senior nurse, they were having the asbestos stripped out of that secure ward. And the workmen came down really, really angry because they were in a place where they felt quite uneasy, saying, "Who is that old lady walking around up there?" And my mum knew there was no one up there.
Oh, man. That's like Session 9 kind of stuff, man. That is scary.
But I have told that about 6 times, so apologies, listeners. That's the only ghost story in my family that I don't have an explanation for, because my mum wouldn't make that kind of thing up.
You know, that puts me in mind, there's a Gene Wolfe, the fantasy writer, has a really, it's almost a flash fiction. I think it's a 4-page story called Fish Story, which is not dissimilar to that. And that is the scariest story I've ever read. So if email me, I'll send you a PDF of it. It's in an anthology called Blackwater. Maybe it's in Blackwaters too. I don't know. But that's a terribly off-putting little story. And your story, I think, is even scarier, man. I'm glad that there's thousands of miles between us, so I don't have to confront that.
I know, but who knows how ghosts travel? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this has been quite the chat. Sorry to leave it on, me happy and you terrified. but honestly, it's been such a pleasure chronicling these books with you as you've been writing them. It's been a real delight to sort of get a peek behind the curtain of this thing as it's being created, because it's such a totemic thing in contemporary horror.
Oh, man, thank you so much.
Thank you for writing it, and Stephen Graham Jones, thank you again for talking Scared.
It's been great.
It really did feel like a privilege, that conversation. And the two that went before it. I'm not easily enraptured by fame or cool. I speak to a lot of cool, famous people. But Stephen Graham Jones has an aura about him. I've gone into all 3 of these conversations a little nervous, a little more on the back foot than usual. Not only because he knows more than I could ever learn about his specialist subjects, slashers and horror of a certain ilk, but because he just knows so much generally, the command he has of literature and culture. I mean, take a look at the list of books we covered in this episode. They're in the show notes, listed like always. How many conversations include references to Dickens, to Umberto Eco, to theorists like Slavoj Žižek and Jean Baudrillard, but also include a heartfelt homage to a Marvel comic book? That's Stephen Graham Jones in a nutshell, horror's renaissance man, who somehow, despite all of that, is just a lovely guy. I'm being a bit nauseating now, aren't I? I was throughout the episode, I suppose, but I stand by my gushing praise. Anyone who listens to my Patreon Hush Tones episodes, in which I give these candid reviews of the books on the show. That's a quick plug there, by the way. Patreon.com/TalkingScaredPod if you want a piece of that and much more. Anyway, anyone who's listened to those will know that I've had my reservations at times about the Indian Lake trilogy. I included both Chainsaw and Reaper in my Esquire Best Horror of the Year list because I do understand that they are technically brilliant, objectively good books. Spoiler, I'll be including Angel too. I also think that the second half of Chainsaw is some of the most astonishingly controlled wildness I've ever read in fiction. How Stephen sustains what he sustained in that last 100 pages will forever be beyond me. And he does it again for even longer in Angel. So I've always usually admired this trilogy, but I think it's only now when it's complete in its full and final arc that I can say I love it. And I think I do. Now, I'm not going to say anything else about The Angel of Indian Lake because it's not necessary. You're going to read it regardless. But dear God, does Stephen hurt, heal and enlarge your heart with Jade's final outing. Obviously, let me know what you think about it, about this conversation, about Stephen's insights, about the characters he dares kill in Angel of Indian Lake. Tell me your thoughts. But if they're on social, for God's sake, keep them spoiler free. You can find me on social, on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, etc. at TalkScaredPod, or email me at TalkingScaredPod@gmail.com. Speaking of social media, though, thanks for all the support this weekend when I was trying desperately to claw to the end of my first piece of Finnish fiction in over 2 years. It's a short story about clowns for this anthology that everyone's submitting to, and I vomited it out 4,000 words in 48 hours. I'm quite excited about it, actually. And you may have seen that a certain Mr. King got involved when I was lamenting my progress. I was moaning on Twitter about how I can't disappear into fiction, how I... It becomes an intellectual exercise, a puzzle to be solved rather than a story to be told. Funnily enough, I'm actually craving what Stephen Graham Jones said about disappearing into his story at the end of that corridor with the door shut. I'm struggling to do that. But anyway, King saw my complaints and he replied. And obviously that's a massive deal for me, my actual hero giving me direct writing advice. Even more so when I followed up and he said, "Thanks, man, you got this." I mean, if that couldn't make me write, nothing could. Turns out I did indeed have it. Story submitted at 2 a.m. the following morning. But the advice he gave me is great advice for anyone who wants to write, I think. This is what he said. "See the story, not the words. See it scene by scene. Move the narrative at the speed it wants to go. Worry about the words? No, that's for the second draft. Most of them in the first draft will be right anyway." Between that and this conversation with Stephen and all the wonderful books I read and people I speak to, I feel newly motivated and invigorated to put pen to paper. And I was thinking, I hope you do too. I know I end up saying no to lots of people who contact me asking me to read their books. It always feels bad to say no, because I know how hard you've worked on that book. It's only because I simply don't have any extra reading time at all. But I am nonetheless thrilled that you're all out there writing, and I hope one day that I do get to read your stories. Yes, you especially, there, the one doubting yourself. Crack on. I'm back next week with another literary hero of mine, Scarlett Thomas, the genre-melting genius behind some of contemporary fiction's greatest tricks. Honestly, read her novel, The End of Mr. Y. It's fantastic. Also read her newest, The Sleepwalkers, because that's what she'll be here to discuss, and in many ways, she's the perfect cool-as-hell follow-up to this week's episode. So I'll speak to you then. But for now, believe in luck. Believe in determination, and for God's sake, believe in yourself. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.